Picture a gray April morning in Seattle, 1924. The water of Lake Washington is cold and still, the sky the color of old pewter. Four open cockpit biplanes sit on their pontoons, rocking gently with the wake of a passing workboat. Their Liberty engines are warming up, the exhaust mixing with the damp morning air. Eight men in leather helmets and sheepskin coats are doing final checks, studying charts, saying their quiet goodbyes. These aren't charts of Washington State. These are charts of the entire planet. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because today we're going back to a morning that changed what human beings thought was possible. But before we get into it, a word from today's sponsor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, back to Seattle. The Army Air Service, which was the air arm of the United States Army before the Air Force became its own branch in 1947, had been planning this mission for 2 years. The idea was simple to state and staggering to execute. Fly around the world, all the way around. In open cockpit biplanes with 12-cylinder engines and no weather radar and no radio that could reach across an ocean. The motivation was partly exploration and partly politics. Aviation in 1924 was still proving itself. The war had shown that aircraft could fight. Now the question was whether they could go anywhere, whether they could be trusted for something bigger than a skirmish over a trench. And the competition was real. A British airman named Stuart McLaren had his own circumnavigation attempt underway. The Italians were preparing. The Argentines had already tried and failed. Everyone understood that being first meant something, not just in terms of pride, but in terms of what it would say to the world about whose aviation industry was setting the pace. The Army Air Service intended to win that race. The aircraft they chose was designed specifically for the mission by the Douglas Aircraft Company out of Santa Monica, California. Douglas was young at the time, just 2 years old as a company, and the World Flight Contract was one of the most demanding projects any American manufacturer had been handed. The airplane they produced was called, straightforwardly, the World Cruiser. It was a biplane, wood and steel tube airframe, fabric covered. The wingspan ran about 50 feet. It carried substantially more fuel than the torpedo bomber it was derived from, because fuel was going to be the defining constraint on every leg of the journey. And it had one feature that was pure engineering common sense. The undercarriage could be swapped between wheels and pontoons in a matter of hours by a capable ground crew. Land in a harbor, swap to wheels, fly to an airfield, swap back to floats for the next water leg. Given the route planned, crossing open ocean basins and remote coastlines in equal measure, that flexibility wasn't a convenience, it was a requirement. The engine was the Liberty 12 400 horsepower, water-cooled V12, a proven design that had powered American aircraft through the war, dependable, but demanding of attention. And as the crews would learn, not entirely happy in tropical heat. Four aircraft were built and given names: the Seattle, the Chicago, the New Orleans. The Boston, the eight men chosen for the flight, were not thrill seekers. They were careful professionals who had spent years accumulating the kind of experience that doesn't come from classrooms. Major Frederick Martin led the expedition from the front cockpit of the Seattle, with Staff Sergeant Alva Harvey as his mechanic and co-pilot. Martin was the senior officer, steady, experienced. Harvey was the kind of enlisted man that makes an officer look good. Lieutenant Lowell Smith flew the Chicago with Lieutenant Leslie Arnold. Smith was quietly capable, the sort of pilot who doesn't generate dramatic stories because nothing goes wrong on his watch if it can be helped. The New Orleans was crewed by Lieutenant Eric Nelson and Lieutenant John Harding. Nelson had a gift for logistics and preparation that made him invaluable on an expedition where the difference between success and failure often came down to whether the right spare part was waiting at the right stop. And the Boston carried Lieutenant Lee Wade and Lieutenant Henry Ogden. Wade was an experienced pilot who had pushed himself and his aircraft hard. Ogden was the kind of mechanic who could keep an engine running when the technical reasons for optimism had run out. On April 6, 1924, all four aircraft lifted off from Seattle and headed north. The first leg of the route ran up through Alaska and out along the Aleutian Chain, that long necklace of volcanic islands stretching west from the tip of the Alaska Peninsula toward Asia. If you've never studied the Aleutians on a globe, do it sometime. They extend farther west than you think. They get close enough to Russia that on a clear day you might see the other side. And the weather that moves through that chain is as raw and unpredictable as any on Earth. Fog, wind, low ceilings, the landscape volcanic and jagged and largely indifferent to aircraft and to the people inside them. The first blow came on April 30th, just 3.5 weeks into the flight. Major Martin and Sergeant Harvey were picking their way through heavy fog near Port Mahler on the Alaska Peninsula, dead reckoning navigation, compass, and stopwatch. The kind of flying where you do the math in your head and hope the numbers match the terrain. In those conditions, in those mountains, the margin is not generous. The Seattle flew into a slope it couldn't see. Both men survived. The aircraft did not. What followed was 10 days that nobody planned for. Martin and Harvey had their survival gear, their skills, and their willingness to keep moving, which turned out to be exactly enough. They worked their way across roughly 10 miles of Alaskan backcountry, through brush and bog and cold, until they reached somewhere they could be found. When rescuers got to them, they were tired and roughed up, but essentially whole. Two men safe. One aircraft gone.
The three remaining aircraft pressed on. Chicago, New Orleans, Boston. They crossed the last of the Aleutians and turned toward the North Pacific. This was the leg that had made planners nervous during the planning phase. Open water, no alternate. A crossing of several hundred miles from Attu, the westernmost Aleutian island, to the Kuril-Ay chain off the Japanese coast. If an engine failed over that water, you came down where you were, and you hoped the Navy destroyer positioned in those waters found you before the sea finished the job. They crossed all three. Japan welcomed them in a way that surprised everyone, including the American crews. Crowds turned out at every stop. Officials offered formal receptions. The Japanese press covered each arrival with genuine enthusiasm. There are photographs from this leg of the trip that show the aircraft entirely surrounded by people, hundreds of them pressing in from every direction, the pilots barely visible above the crowd. From Japan, they crossed to China, Canton, and then south and west through Indochina and into Burma and across to India. This is where the heat began to matter. The Liberty 12 had been designed for the comparatively temperate air of Europe and the American training fields. It ran differently in tropical conditions. Oil consumption increased. Cylinder head temperatures climbed at each stop in Southeast Asia. The co-pilots, who were also the mechanics, climbed out of their cockpits and immediately began pulling cowlings, working in the heat, on airfields that were often little more than cleared jungle. Now here's where it gets interesting. These men developed a practiced intimacy with their aircraft that pilots today rarely experience. Modern aviation is largely about systems management, monitoring displays, managing redundancy. What those crews had was something older and more direct. They knew what their engine sounded like when it was healthy and what it sounded like when it was starting to complain. They could hear a problem coming before the instruments showed it. That knowledge came from being the person who adjusted the valve timing and torqued the cylinder head studs, not the person who called maintenance. There's a discipline in that, a kind of accountability. When you maintain the machine that keeps you alive, you don't cut corners, and you don't guess. They crossed India into Persia, through what we now call Iraq, into Turkey, and then into Europe. By the time they crossed into France, the flight was international news. The British covered it. The French covered it. The competition from other nations was falling further behind schedule by the week, and it was becoming clear to everyone following the story that the Americans were going to win the race. They flew north through Europe, Scotland, the Orkney Islands, and then toward the North Atlantic. The Boston had been fighting a battle nobody outside the crew fully knew about. Lee Wade and Henry Ogden had been nursing their engine through a cumulative list of issues, each one manageable on its own, the combination of them worrying. They were good pilots and attentive mechanics, and they had kept their aircraft flying through conditions that would have grounded lesser men. But the North Atlantic doesn't care about how hard you've been trying. Near the Faroe Islands, the Boston's engine quit. Wade brought the aircraft down onto the surface of the North Atlantic. An open ocean forced landing in a loaded biplane in that cold gray water. He put it down clean. Neither man was hurt. A Navy destroyer was positioned in those waters, pre-positioned there during the planning phase months earlier, specifically for moments like this. Wade and Ogden were rescued. The Boston was lost, two aircraft gone, two crews alive. The calculation that had been made during the planning phase, that the men mattered more than the machines, had been validated twice. The Chicago and the New Orleans pressed on Smith and Arnold, Nelson and Harding. A replacement aircraft was eventually provided for Wade and Ogden, christened the Boston II, and they rejoined the formation for the final legs. But the original terms of the expedition were clear. Only aircraft that had flown every leg of the route would count as having circumnavigated the globe. The Chicago and the New Orleans would carry the record. They crossed Iceland, then Greenland. The North Atlantic in late summer is not gentle, and Greenland in any season is Greenland, fog and ice and weather systems that develop fast and offer no apology for the inconvenience. Smith and Nelson flew through it. Then south, Labrador, Nova Scotia, the eastern seaboard of the United States, where the country that had been following this story in newspapers and early radio broadcasts for 5 months was waiting for them. On September 28, 1924, the Chicago and the New Orleans touched down in Seattle. 175 days after departure, 363 hours of flying time, 26,345 miles. The first circumnavigation of the globe by air was complete. Lowell Smith and Eric Nelson received the Mackay Trophy, all the crews received the Distinguished Service Medal, and the welcome home in Seattle, by all accounts, was as loud as it was long overdue. I want to say something about what it means to have done this in 1924, because I think we lose it if we just read the numbers. There was no satellite phone, no emergency locator transmitter, no weather uplink. When the Seattle went into that Alaskan hillside, the other three crews found out about it, the same way the public did, slowly and secondhand, long after it happened. When the Boston went down in the North Atlantic, the destroyer was there because a planner in Washington had put it there months earlier, not because someone hit a button and had a rescue helicopter airborne in minutes. Every takeoff was irrevocable. You advanced the throttle, and you went, and whatever the world decided to put in your way, you managed it with what you had in the cockpit and what you knew from the years that had brought you to that moment. They did this in open cockpits, wind in their faces at cruise speed for hours, noise and vibration constant, cold over the North Pacific and the North Atlantic, heat over Asia, every navigation fix computed by hand, every landmark verified against a paper chart back when AVGS was cheap and airspace was free. Pilots used to talk about this flight the way other people talked about Everest, the first time, nobody had done it. And then somebody did, a few, somebodies actually, who swapped pontoons for wheels in Japanese harbors and pulled cylinders in Burmese heat, and brought their aircraft home across an ocean that took one of them anyway. The Chicago today hangs in the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. It's there alongside the Wright Flyer and the Spirit of St. Louis and John Glenn's Friendship 7. It belongs in that company. If you ever walk through that building, stop under the Chicago, look up at the open cockpit, the two seats. Think about Lowell Smith sitting in the front one, crossing the North Pacific in 1924. Think about what the water looked like from 600 feet, what the Liberty 12 sounded like, what he was thinking about when there was nothing below him but ocean for as far as he could see. History drawn from the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and the Air Force Historical Research Agency in Montgomery, Alabama, which holds the original expedition logs, worth a deep read if you're inclined. I'm Taildragger. This is The Hangar. More at radiohangar.com. Safe skies.